This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
I'd like to thank Christy Mazura Davis and the Lannan Foundation for inviting me here to Santa Fe this evening to introduce to you Juno Diaz. But first, let's look at the language. It leaps, it lolls about, it lingers on the street, it lunges into the precinct of paraliterature, plundering comics and science fiction and fantasy for its kerygma and mythological comparisons, its superlative metaphors and exemplaries, the way Cyril Connolly's Mandarin writers mine Shakespeare, mythology, and the Bible for their hypograms and paralogisms. It plunges through already existing Spanglish and a more traditional Spanish so that, especially when we get to the novel of Oscar's brief and wondrous life, if we are not a native Spanish reader, such as myself, then each compiles her or his own paradigm of personal wonderings to rival Burgess's clockwork glossary or Heinlein's harsh mistress's Russian royster. Colmado, bodega to us longtime New Yorkers, that little corner store, but idiosyncratically often part of the very house itself. Carajo, the hell with it, when, for whatever reasons, you can't find what you want at El Comado. Chancletas, the cheap flip-flops you wear when you can't afford Tevas, and that you hit the kids with, if you have to. Vergüenza, something you haven't a speck of, shame. Galletazo, as in, dale una galletazo, give her a smack, or, as a recent online cabron translated it, a bitch slap, or, in the Harlem dialect I was brought up with, upside yo head. More neutrally, an open-handed slap, what you might use una de las chancletas for. Of course, it's that neutrality of language Diaz wants to get away from. His language is loaded and weighted, not to slow it down, but to fuel it with a roller coaster's energy that sends it careening around the hidden formality of his subject. The beginning and end of Oscar's saga mirror one another. Young Oscar is to Ana Obregón, as the older Oscar is to Ivan Pimentel, where Manny, the Gulf War returnee, stands in the way of the adolescent consummation. The captain is the adult adulterator of Yvonne and Oscar's love. Between them are strung the stories of an island, or half an island, the San Domingo side of Hispaniola. More memorably, that's the stories of its women, La Inca, Oscar's grandmother, his sister Lola, and his mother Hypatia Balicia Cabral. For Oscar, and in her way, Lola, relive his mother's early life as a victim of the Trujillo dictatorship in a diabolical intergenerational repetition compulsion where we can only watch its events interweave with an unsettling psychological succinctness in which every effort of the former to protect the latter from those lethal horrors, beaten, set on fire, left for dead, once endured and barely survived, only ensure that the children cannot possibly avoid the same fate, the fuku, the fatalism that fuels the fall of all the West's tragedies. For a while, though, let's put wow away and look at something that at first might seem smaller. Let's give a nod to negocios, business negotiations, that Diaz mini-epic that sits, rather like Joyce's The Dead, the daedal that focuses all the intricacies of Dubliners, climaxing with its intricacies all the deftly intercrafted dramas of Drown. What emerges from what's submerged in this whirlpool of a story? A 20-year-old father, Ramon, leaves his family, his wife, and three children in the Dominican Republic to come to America. The defection is ambiguously positioned. Yes, he happens to be having an affair about which his wife is deeply unhappy, but the whole business, the negotiations with his father-in-law for money to finance the trip, are absorbed in the general Dominican diaspora. The stories in Drown have learned their necessary lessons of stylistic economy and reticence from Raymond Carver, without which working-class fiction could simply not be taken seriously in the decade of their appearance. But even besides the shift of their scrupulous technical virtuosity over into the richly observed reality of Dominican life in New York, Miami, the island, or northern New Jersey, something else was going on that made these tales, this tale in particular, something very much its own. The repeating form of fatalism we have already mentioned in Oscar Wao is here in embryo. In his years in the States, Ramon begins a second family, even while, now and again, he retains his allegiances to the first. But in the end, to reunite with the former, he must abandon the latter. And from this double rupture, the adult son of the first concludes the tale with a visit to his abandoned second wife. I found the story devastatingly effective and deeply moving. There is nothing in it that is not prepared for dramatically. This novella, The Way Ramon is Trapped into All His Flights, is worthy of any of the great 19th century social novelists. The stymieing of his efforts by social habitations that, at least once, even he can recognize as a racism he is powerless to challenge, is played out in such a low-key and inevitable manner that it slides from under the name to join the inevitable, the unconquerable, that the determination to endure alone conquers. The third child in a family of five, Juno Diaz was born in Santo Domingo in December 1968. He came to this country in 1974. He attended Keene College in Union, New Jersey, Rutgers University, and received his MFA from Cornell University in 1995. His stories have appeared in the Paris Review, Best American Short Stories of 96, 97, 99, and 2000, African Voices, and The New Yorker. Among many honors, he has received a John Simon Guggenheim Fellowship, a Lila Acheson Wallace Reader's Digest Award, the 2002 Penn Malamud Award, and the Rome Prize from the American Academy of Arts in Letters. In 2007, his novel, The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Best Novel of that year. And in April 2008, the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Please join me this evening in welcoming Juno Diaz.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I always like the polite applause of the young people. Y'all like? Is this Mrs. Nelson's class? Is this true? I met your teacher and two of the students out there. How many of them are there? Yes? That's a group of students? Y'all high school? Seniors or juniors or what? The seniors are like very excited. Okay. Any like first and second year students? Awesome. Straight up seniors and juniors. Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming. Yeah. Your teacher is really quite wonderful. Myself, I would be taxed to drag my students anywhere. So I do it, but oh, shit.
We have to drag her places.
Oh, for real? Like where?
Everywhere.
Okay. Shit. So it's a fair exchange, okay. Guys, I wanted to thank you all for coming out this evening. Thank you so much. I wanted to thank the Lannan Foundation for having us. I wanted to thank Christy Mazur Davis for helping organizing, making sure we got here. That young sister does the work of 20. And for all the folks who are... see that? Adult clapping? They put some goddamn wrist into it, you know? So, some old roughneck kids up here. You know you can clap better than that. And again, thank you so much. It's a great honor to be here again. So, I'm just going to read. They asked me to read for like 30 minutes, which is incredibly long, yeah? I mean, I think it's unbearably long. So I'll try to spend... This has not got down 1 minute. Is there any way to, like, get that clock down? Because I thought I have wasted 4 minutes talking to y'all. Yeah. So let me find my page. I had a wonderful time just beforehand. Y'all know you have, like, a crazy amount of science fiction and fantasy writers in this town? Holy shit, man. Yeah, George R.R. Martin. Yeah, he bought me some water. Thank you, George, wherever you are. Yeah. Yeah, you guys have remarkable writers here. So I'm just going to read a small piece, and then actually, I probably have to read three small pieces since the clock will not go down. All right. So, whatever. I wrote this novel. I'm just going to read some pieces of it. Different characters. So the first piece of it is from the sister. Her name is Lola. She's a teenager. This all takes place in central New Jersey, where I grew up. Right? I guess there's not much you need to know. It's in second person, so we'll do it from there. I'm only going to read a couple pages of it, and then we'll do something else. So it's called Wildwood, yeah? It is never the changes we want that change everything. This is how it all starts, with your mother calling you into the bathroom. You will remember what you were doing at that precise moment for the rest of your life. You were reading Watership Down, and the rabbits were making their dash for the boat, and you did not want to stop reading. Oh. The nerds start laughing immediately. No. Thank you. I actually appreciate it. Yeah. You did not want to stop reading. The book has to go back to your brother. But then your mother called again, louder, her "I am not fucking around" voice. And you mumbled irritably, "Sí, señora." Your mother was standing in front of the medicine cabinet mirror, naked from the waist up, her bra slung around her like a torn sail, the scar on her back as vast and inconsolable as a sea. You want to return to your book to pretend that you had not heard her, but it is too late. Her eyes meet yours, the same big smoky eyes that you will have in the future. "Ven acá," she commands. Your mother is frowning at something on one of her breasts. For the record, your mother's breasts are immensities. One of the wonders of the world. The only ones that you've seen that are bigger are in nudie magazines and on really fat ladies. They are 36 triple Ds, and the aureolas are as big as saucers and as black as pitch. And at their edges are fierce little hairs that sometimes your mother plucks and sometimes she does not. These breasts have always embarrassed you, and when you walk in public with your mother, you are always conscious of them. After her face and her hair, her chest is what she is most proud of. Your father, your mother likes to brag, could never get enough of these. But given the fact that he ran off on her after the third year of marriage, it seemed in the end he could, yeah? You dread conversations with your mother, those one-sided dressing downs. You have figured that your mother has called you into the bathroom to give you another earful about your diet. Your mother is convinced that if you eat more plátanos, you will suddenly acquire her same extraordinary train-wrecking secondary sex characteristics. Even at that age, you were nothing if not your mother's daughter. You were already 12 years old and already as tall as she was, a long, slender-necked ibis of a girl. You had her green eyes, clearer though, and her straight hair, which makes you look more Hindu than Dominican, and a behind that the boys have not been able to stop talking about since the fifth grade, but whose appeal you do not yet understand. You have her complexion, too, which means that you are dark. But for all of your similarities, the tides of inheritance have yet to reach your chest. You have only the slightest hint of breast. From most angles, you are as flat as a board, and you are thinking that your mother is going to order you to stop wearing bras again because, in her words, they are suffocating your potential breasts, discouraging them from developing. You are ready to argue with your mother to the death because you are as protective, as possessive of your new bras as you are of the pads that you can now buy yourself. But no, your mother does not say a word about eating more plátanos. Instead, she takes your right hand and guides you. Your mother is rough in all things, but this time she is gentle. You did not think her capable of it. "Do you feel that?" she asks you. At first, all you feel is the heat of her and the density of that tissue, like a bread that has never stopped rising. She kneads your fingers into her. You're as close as the two of you have ever been, and her breathing is what you will remember. "Don't you feel that?" She turns towards you. "Coño, muchacha del diablo, stop looking at me and feel." So, you close your eyes, and your fingers are pushing down, and of course you are thinking of Helen Keller, and how, when you were a little girl, you wanted to be just like Helen Keller, except a little more nunnish, yeah? And suddenly, without a warning, you do feel something, a knot just beneath her skin, tight and secretive as a plot. And at that moment, for reasons you will never quite understand, you are overcome by the feeling, the premonition, that something in your life is about to change. You become lightheaded, and you can feel a throbbing in your blood, a beat, a rhythm, a drum. Bright lights zoom through you like photon torpedoes, like comets. You do not know how or why you know this thing, but that you know it cannot be doubted. It is exhilarating. For as long as you have been alive, you have had bruja ways. Even your mother will begrudge you that much. "Hija del Iborio," she called you, after you pictured Diaz winning lottery number for her, and you assumed that Liborio was a relative. That was before Santo Domingo, before you knew about the great power of God. "I feel it," you say too loudly. "Lo siento." And, like that, everything changes. Before the winter is out, the doctors remove the breasts that you were needing, along with the axillary lymph node. Because of the operations, your mother will have trouble lifting her arm over her head for the rest of her life. Because of the therapy, her hair begins to fall out, and one day she pulls all that's left out herself and puts it inside of a plastic bag. You change too. Not right away, but it happens. And it is in that bathroom where it all begins, where you begin. Okay, that's one. So, y'all very kind. You should see it from my point of view. For the most part, all I can see is glasses and hair. You know? Some extraordinary dudes. So, You're far ahead of the game than I am. Yeah. So, guys, you know, there was the thing about starting readings is that you're always so nervous you forget to do what you're really supposed to do as well. I also wanted to thank my introducer, Samuel R. Delaney, for that stupendous introduction. Yeah, guys, you get like one great intervention. As writers, you know, you spend your life waiting for somebody to give you a dope-ass introduction. You want somebody to be like, yo, he's the fucking shit. So, you know, I finally got one. Thanks, Chip. For real, that was wonderful. Thank you. So, I'll read another piece. Was anybody here? I mean, I know this is unlikely, but I'll check. Was anybody in D.C. for the inauguration at all? Not a one, right? Yeah. I so wanted to go, man. Yeah. No, when you're old, you can afford to do these things, guys. You know? This is the shit that being old is about. You're like, I'll go see Obama. You know? So, yeah, I think it's that we're in such extraordinary times, even as writers, I don't think we can make this shit up. Yeah, this is extraordinary moment. Extraordinary moment. It's like the one time I really am astonished and elated that I'm like alive to report this. I feel like if I have grandchildren, I'll be living off this shit, you know? But I mean, you must feel the same way. I mean, I feel like I am going to be living off this for the rest of my life. I'm going to be like, grandkids, gather around, you little rats. You know, let me tell you some shit. Yeah. We have really done something beyond the imagination, you know? And the only people I feel bad at is the people who voted against him. It's so weird. It's like the people who like would vote against like civil rights. 30 years later, they're like, fuck, you know? So I think about them. I think about them. So I'll read you another small piece. Yeah. 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 I'll just read you another small piece. This comes from right from the beginning of the book. This is how the book begins. Yeah. Completely different voice, but it's the way it goes. All right. They say it came first from Africa, carried in the screams of the enslaved. That it was the deathbane of the Tainos, uttered just as one world perished and another began. That it was a demon drawn into creation through the nightmare door that was cracked open in the Antilles. Fuku Americanus, or more colloquially, Fuku, generally understood to be a curse or a doom of some kind, specifically understood to be the curse or the doom of the New World. Also called the Fuku of the Admiral, because the Admiral was both its midwife and one of its great European victims. Despite discovering the New World, in quotes, the Admiral died miserable and syphilitic, hearing dike divine voices. In Santo Domingo, the land that he loved best, the Admiral's very name has become synonymous with both kinds of Fuku, little and large. To say his name aloud, or even to hear it, is to invite calamity on the head of you and yours. No matter what its provenance or its name, it is believed that the arrival of Europeans on Hispaniola unleashed the Fuku on the world, and we have all been in the shit ever since. Santo Domingo might be Fuku's kilometer zero, its port of entry, but we are all of us its children, whether we know it or not. But Fuku isn't just ancient history, a ghost story from the past with no power to scare. In my parents' day, Fuku was real as shit, something your everyday person could believe in. Everybody knew somebody who had been eaten by a Fuku, just like everybody knew someone who worked up at the Palacio. It was in the air, you could say, though like all the most important things on the island, not something folks really talked about. But in those old days, Fuku had it good. It even had a hype man of sorts, a high priest, you could say, our then dictator for life, Rafael Trujillo. No one knows whether Trujillo was the curse's servant or its master, its agent or its principal, but it was clear that he and it had an understanding, that the two of them was tight. It was believed, even in educated circles, that anyone who plotted against Trujillo would incur a Fuku most powerful down to the seventh generation and beyond. If you even thought a bad thing about Trujillo, foie, a hurricane would sweep your family out to the sea. Foie, a boulder would fall out of a clear sky and squash you flat. Foie, the shrimp that you ate today would be the cramp that killed you tomorrow. Which explains why everybody who tried to assassinate Trujillo always got done. Why those dudes who finally did kill him all died so horrifically. And what about Kennedy? Kennedy was the one who green-lighted the assassination of Trujillo in 1961, who ordered the CIA to deliver arms to the island. Bad move, Captain. For what Kennedy's intelligence experts failed to tell him was what every single Dominican from the richest Habao and Mao to the poorest Wei in El Buey knew. That whoever killed Trujillo, their family would suffer a fuku so dreadful it would make the one that attached itself to the admiral, Jojote, in comparison. You want a final conclusive answer to the Warren Commission question, who killed John F. Kennedy? Let me, your humble watcher, reveal once and for all the God's honest truth. It wasn't the mob or LBJ or the ghost of Marilyn fucking Monroe. It wasn't aliens or the KGB or a lone gunman. It wasn't the Hunts Brothers of Texas or Lee Harvey or the Trilateral Commission. It was Trujillo. It was the Fuku. Where in Coñazo do you think the curse of the Kennedys comes from? And what about Vietnam? Why do you think that the greatest power in the world lost its first war to a pissant third world country like Vietnam? I mean, Negro, please. It might interest you to know that just as the United States was ramping up its involvement in Vietnam, President Lyndon B. Johnson launched an illegal invasion of the Dominican Republic, April 28, 1965. Santo Domingo was Iraq before Iraq was Iraq. A smashing military success for the United States, and many of the same units and intelligence teams that took part in the democratization of Santo Domingo were immediately shipped off to Saigon. And what do you think these soldiers, technicians, these spooks carried with them in their rucksacks, in their suitcases, in their shirt pockets, on the hair inside of their nostrils, caked up around their shoes? Just a little gift from my people to America, a small repayment for an unjust war. That's right, Fuku. Which is why it's important to remember that Fuku doesn't always strike like lightning. Sometimes it works patiently, drowning a nigger by degrees, like with the admiral or the U.S. and the paddies outside of Saigon. Sometimes Fuku is slow, sometimes it is fast. It is doomish that way, makes it harder for you to put your finger on, to brace yourself against. But be assured, like Darkseid's Omega effect, like Morgoth's Bane, no matter how many turns and digressions this shit may take, it always, and I mean always, gets its man. Okay, that's two.
Yeah.
That's just some shit. Ah, the youth. Yes, okay. Better than that weak-ass clap. I agree. That works. That works. Of course, I was... me and my dear friend Chip Delaney, we were running through the airport and we caught exactly no minutes of Obama's speech. Yeah. So we have no idea. Was it any good? Yeah. I didn't even see it on YouTube because we don't have our computers with us, you know? I still think we're in some sorry shape when, like, the first thing the president signs is that nobody in my cabinet can be a criminal. Like, that's just some wild stuff right there. What has come before has been very sorry, my friends. Yeah? Yeah. I know this is messed up, but as soon as I got under the lights, like, my nose started running. Does anyone have a tissue? I'm not even kidding. Like, up front, anyone? Wait, someone does. Is there someone here? Oh, it's coming up. Oh, thank you. Guys, that was amazing. Thank you. I know, super gross and embarrassing, but... Yeah. Thank you so much. Who was this? I have to throw it back. Here, you can pass it back. I don't want to hit. Yeah. So I can't remember because, again, us East Coast people. New Mexico, yeah, y'all voted for Obama. Is this one of the states that did? I'm sorry, guys. I'm going to be excited for this for about 400 years. So I got some of y'all, like, already over this, but I'm not. You know, I'm like, fuck that. My president's black, son. Yeah. All right, so I'll read just two small pieces, and then we'll call it a day. Yeah? Yeah? Hmm. Nice. Nice. Did you guys hear that comment? I am very glad. I am embarrassed for the both of us, yo. All right, so... I know you're not, hon. All right, so all you need to know now is... this is messed up because I'm sort of giving you the ending of the book, but it's only in the title. Chill. It's like, you know... Chronicle of a Death Foretold. They're like, don't tell me the ending. Give me a break. All right? You're straight. You'll be all right. You know? So, yeah, this is the end, and there's not much to know. The sort of the sideways protagonist of the book, his name is Oscar De La Hoya, who's this really big, fat nerd, super nerd, like the illest herb in the earth. Yeah, he falls in love with a stripper in the Dominican Republic who happens to be married or happens to be dating an incredibly corrupt and violent police officer. So this is Oscar's return after having been violently beaten. He returns to the Dominican Republic to attempt to regain the love of his life. Yeah. Guys, I don't know, man. All right. Lannon, just so you know, the comment was, strippers need love too. Oh, Mrs. Nelson. I have an older sister who would agree wholeheartedly with you, madame. So, all right, it's called The Final Voyage, yeah? And here we go. The last time Oscar flew to Santo Domingo, he had been startled when the applause broke out. But this time, he was prepared. And when the plane landed, he clapped until his hands stung. As soon as he hit the airport exit, he called Clevis, and homeboy picked him up about an hour later, found him surrounded by taxistas who were trying to pull him into their cab. Cristiano, Clevis said, what are you doing here? It is the ancient powers, Oscar said grimly. They will not leave me alone. They parked in front of Iban's house, that's the girl he's in love with, and waited almost 7 hours before she returned. Gleevis tried to talk him out of it, but Oscar would not listen. Then she pulled up in the Pathfinder. She looked thinner. His heart seized like a bad leg, and for a moment he thought about letting the whole thing go, about returning to New Jersey, to Don Bosco, and getting on with his miserable life. But then she stooped over, as if the whole world was watching, and that settled that. He winched down the window. "Ebon," he said. She stopped, shaded her eyes, and then recognized him. She said his name too, Oscar. He popped the door and walked over to where she was standing and embraced her. Her first words, "Mi amor, you have to leave right now." In the middle of the street, he told her how it was. He told her that he was in love with her and that he had been hurt, and now he was all right. And if she could have a week alone with her, if he could have a week alone with her, one short week, then everything would be fine in him, and he would be able to face what he had to face. And she said, "I don't understand." And so he said it again, that he loved her more than the universe, and it wasn't something that he could shake. "So please come away with me for a little while. Lend me your strength, and then it would all be over if she wanted." Maybe Ebon did love him a little bit. Maybe in her heart of hearts, she left the gym bag on the concrete and got into the taxi with him. But she had known men like the Capitan all her life, had been forced to work in Europe 1 year straight by niggas like that before she could start earning her own money, knew also that in Santo Domingo, they call a cop divorce a bullet. The gym bag was not left on the street. "I am going to call him, Oscar," she said. "So please go before he gets here." "I am not going to go anywhere," he said. "Go," she said. "No," he said. He let himself into his abuelita's house. He still had the key. The capitan showed up about an hour later, honked his horn a long time, but Oscar didn't bother to go out. He had gone out all of his grandmother's photographs, was going through each and every one. When his grandmother, La Inca, returned from the bakery and found him scribbling at the kitchen table. "Oscar?" she said in disbelief. "Yes, abuelo," he said, not looking up. "It is me." For 27 days, he did two things. He researched, wrote, and he chased her. Sat in front of her house, called her on her beeper, went to the world-famous Riverside where she worked, walked to the supermarket whenever he saw her truck pull out just in case she was on her way there. 9 times out of 10, she was not. The neighbors, when they saw him on the curb, shook their heads and said, "Look at that, loco." 27 days. How incredibly short are 27 days. One evening, the capitan and his friend stalked into the Riverside, and Oscar stared at the man for a good 10 seconds, and then, whole body shaking, he left. Didn't bother to call Gleevis, jumped in the first taxi he could find. Once in the parking lot of the Riverside, he tried to kiss Ebon again, and she turned away with her head, but not her body. "Please don't. He will kill us." 27 days. Wrote on each and every one of them. Wrote almost 300 pages, if his letters are to be believed. Almost had it, too, he said to me one night on the phone, one of the few calls that he made to us. "What?" I wanted to know. "What do you almost have?" "You will see," was all that he would say. And then the expected happened. One night, he and Gleevis were driving back from the world-famous Riverside, and they had to stop at a light, and that was when two men got into the cab with them. It was, of course, the capitan's lieutenants, Gorilla Grodd and Solomon Grundy. "Good to see you again," Grodd said, and then they beat Oscar as well as they could, given the limited space inside the cab. This time, Oscar did not cry when they drove him back to the cane fields. Safra would be here soon, and the cane had grown well and thick, and in places you could hear the stalks clack, clack, clacking against each other like triffids, and you could also hear Creole voices lost in the night. The smell of the ripening cane was unforgettable, and there was a moon, a beautiful full moon, and Gleevis begged the men to spare Oscar, but they laughed. You should be worrying, Grodd said, about yourself. Oscar laughed too, a little bit through his broken mouth. Don't worry, Glebus, he said. They are too late. Actually, Grodd said, I would say we are just in time. They drove past the bus stop, and for a second, Oscar imagined he saw his whole family getting on a guagua, even his poor dead abuelo and his poor dead abuela. And who is driving the bus but the mongoose? And who is the cobrador but the man without a face? But it was nothing but a fantasy, gone as soon as he blinked. And when the car stopped in the cane field, Oscar sent telepathic messages to his mother. I love you, senora. To his deal, quit deal and live. To Lola, I am so sorry it happened. I will always love you. To all the women he had ever loved, Olga, Maritza, Anna, Jenny, Karen, and all the ones whose names he'd ever forgotten. And of course, to Yvonne. They walked him into the cane and then turned him around. He tried to stand bravely. They looked at Oscar and he looked at them and then he started to speak, the words coming out like they belonged to someone else, his Spanish good for once. He told them that what they were doing was wrong, that they were going to take a great love out of the world. Love was a rare thing, he said, easily confused with a million other things. And if anyone knew this to be true, it was him. He told them about Yvonne and the way he loved her and how much they had risked and that they had started to dream the same dreams and say the same words. He told them that it was only because of her love that he'd been able to do the things that he had done, the thing that they could never stop. Told them that if they killed him, they would probably feel nothing, and their children would probably feel nothing either, not until they were old and weak or about to be struck by a car, and then they would sense him waiting for them on the other side. And over there, he wouldn't be no fat boy or dork or kid no girl ever loved. Over there, he would be a hero, an avenger. Because anything you dream, he said, you can be. They waited respectfully for him to finish, and then they said, their faces slowly disappearing into the gloom, listen, we'll let you go if you tell us what fuego means in English. Fire, he blurted out, unable to help himself. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Okay, well, now we come to the conversation part. There are a lot. I have the honor and the pleasure of having taught Juno's first book, Drown, several times, and just recently I've reread it. So it's one of the things that's on my mind, and I have a question about that. When the book came out, it received a great deal of praise, a great deal of very well-deserved praise. But you mentioned to me earlier when we were talking that one of the things that none of the reviewers ever talked about was the title story, Drown. Mm. Do you have any thoughts about that and why that was the one thing that everybody seemed to stay away from?
Oof, yeah. I mean, you know, Chip, you know this. That, you know, as a writer, you're always, of course, if you read your reviews, the ones that you read, you're always like, you find deficient, yeah? But I always found it very, I did find it incredibly strange that the name of my first book was Drown, and I think of the 10 reviews that I read, the rest went right back to my mother. Not a single one of them mentioned that fact about the title story. And you know, I asked a friend of mine who is in charge of these things, who actually read all the reviews and told me, yeah, dude, they never talk about that story. And in the story, of course, this is, well, not of course, but for those of you who haven't read it, in the story, it's about two friends, one of them stuck in a neighborhood, and the other one who's gotten out. And the two of them have, for the best way to describe it, the story does a better way of describes it better, they have a homosexual encounter. And for me, I thought it was a really important part of the story, of the whole collection, because this was a book, my first book was, had everything to do with sort of, at least in my mind, when I was writing it, I was thinking of a book that had everything to do with masculinity, how masculinity got constructed in the community that I grew up in, which was a Dominican immigrant community, you know, and masculinity, the way I grew up, was always constructed. If you took away from the young guys, when I was young and my friends, if you took away the word faggot from us, probably 50% of our vocabulary would vanish. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, so much homophobia was, we were just taught so much of it. And part of it, though, was that that homophobia was masking an enormous amount of homoeroticism, an enormous amount of give and take in these, sexual identities. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was trying to get at in the story in some way, and I thought it was kind of important. But mm-hmm.
And many of the characters throughout the entire book are drowning in the landscape in which they live. I think that's another thing that's going on in that. And the homosexuality has offered one of them a way out.
Yeah.
You know. And the other one doesn't want to take that way out at all, and it's, you know, and it was very powerful. I felt the first time I read it, I was rather troubled by the story, and now I've read it about six times, and it's one of my favorites in the entire book. Drown is a, for those of you who have not read it, it's a, not only is it a wonderful collection of 10 stories to read, it's also a wonderful collection to reread, because every time you do, you see relations between the various and sundry stories, and you see patterns that, you know, that you only sort of got the ghost of before. There's a there's a gold crown pool table that kind of moves through the stories.
Pool tables.
Yeah, and the first time you read it, you know, every once in a while you notice this pool table, and then you realize it's a major. I think the ugly word is symbol, and it's a very strong one. In Oscar, to go back to the novel that you just read from, one of the things that you do. And I wonder if you can talk about where you got the idea for it from, is you use the mythology of science fiction, comics, and popular culture in general as a kind of support for all the thinking that the main character does. Everything he's always comparing it to something out of science fiction or fantasy. We got it. There were, even in the parts you read, there were a couple of moments like mm-hmm. that. What gave you that idea? Yeah,
it's a really good question, Chip. I mean, part of what's going on with a book like this is, especially if you're dealing with the, you know, on one level, I was dealing with Caribbean history. Yeah, specifically a Dominican history that was so utterly fantastic. There's been a lot of kind of critical writing about how the life that we're all leading these days has become science fictional. You know, that like we're now living in a moment where people are acting like kind of Star Trek characters, you know, and the world has a lot of science fictional elements. But I never had a sense that you had to come to a kind of hyper modernity like we have now for things to be science fictional. I always found both the recent and the deep history of the Caribbean, the Dominican Republic, to be so incredibly fantastic that it was only the narratives that I encountered in books, science fiction books like Dune, and stories like Star Wars and things like that. I felt that science fiction did a better job of helping to describe the history of the Dominican Republic than realistic fiction, you know? I mean, I always say it's a perfect example is how do you describe
what it is to leave the Dominican Republic in 1974, when I left Santo Domingo, the neighborhood I left in, no one had a TV, no one had a telephone, and there was almost no electricity. And we left that space-time, and after a four-hour flight, I found myself in New Jersey in an air-conditioned heated apartment with cable, you know? And it felt like time travel as a kid. You know, as a way to sort of understand this, it felt very much like time travel. But even, again, most of what we would consider the roots of science fiction narrative have been predicated so much on encounters with the other. I mean, the Caribbean figures deeply in the, we would call, the power chords of science fiction. The idea of aliens, well, gee whiz, the Caribbean. The idea of, like, breeding people or breeding a race, well, the Caribbean, slavery. You know, the idea of like an evil emperor. Well, take a look at a plantation and you'll see some wild similarities. And so part of it was using science fiction to help describe the Dominican Republic, but also using Dominican history to sort of nudge and remind folks who are into science fiction that a lot of what's underpinning what we would consider just popular science fiction stuff, has at its heart the shadow of the history of the New World.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the way, also the fact that you bring it into the very language that you use to tell the story is a very effective strategy, narrative strategy, and it adds an incredible energy to the book, which is that and the general use of street language. This is a book that I defy anyone to take a long time to read. It goes like a torpedo, you know, scooting along.
Well, you know, I just to touch that one thing you said, though, guys, what's so strange, especially if you're writing in a tradition like I'm writing, where I'm including a lot of Spanish in my work, there's an enormous amount of resistance out there. In other words, if you have 500 Spanish words in your novel, you'd be surprised how much people resist that. And yet, if I have 500 words in Elvish, nobody gives a fuck. Nobody gives a damn. And I think part of having all that science fiction and comic book, all the kind of nerd references mingled in there with all the Spanish, is to remind people that, you know, and especially a reader, is that there's plenty of what I would call mutant or alien language usage in literature that nobody ever checks its passport.
Right.
In science fiction and fantasy, you could have thousands of made-up words and nobody ever has a problem with it. Mm-hmm. But you put 20 words in Spanish or 20 words in Creole or 20 words in Arabic, and the same people who are studying Elvish are going to be like, this is wrong. You know? Yeah. And I just... That was part of the project, sort of putting those two people together.
Yeah, uh-huh. My next question was going to be, but you've kind of answered it anyway, when I was sort of spending a little time online and seeing what other people's responses to the book had been, you could pick up people sometimes talking about the Spanish and the fact that they didn't know what some of these words were, and there was a hostility there every once in a while. You would find it. And I couldn't help thinking that there you were growing up in northern New Jersey in a Dominican, neighborhood. I grew up in Harlem as a black kid in Harlem. I always had to read with a dictionary, you know, because I didn't know, you know. And so reading with a dictionary is, in a way, part of the childhood reading experience of those who come from a marginal situation. We always have to look up the words. And so this is just an extension of it. Whereas I think there's some people who think, well, why am I being asked to do this? To go back to the short stories, because the short stories the character of Junior comes back in the novel. How did you make the voice of Junior his own? Because you use street language all the time, but then when you get to Junior, a paragraph after he started speaking, if you've read the short stories, you recognize, you know who we're back with. How'd you do? That's an amazing feat. How'd you do it? Or can you tell us?
Well, no. I mean, Chip, you know as well as a serious writer, you know that any of the effects, whether it's a character's voice or the language, any of the effects which are kind of pleasing to a reader, they take such an enormous amount of work. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Junior's voice. I mean, it just sounds like some dude who probably you won't like too much sitting across from you in a train and telling you some crazy long story. But that took a huge amount of work. In normal life, a jerk can come up to you and talk to you for 2 hours without a problem. But to actually write that and make it like even remotely interesting, it just meant that I spent a lot of time crafting it. I mean, I hate to sound like... Part of what killed me in this novel was getting Junior's voice, his sister, I mean, Oscar's voice, Oscar's sister's voice correct. Mm-hmm. You know, and you still don't get it right, guys. I mean, as a writer, what you discover is you spend more time on your ass than you do scoring points, you know? Mm-hmm. You try, but it's really difficult. It's hard to nail this stuff, you know? Even a book that they'll give a big award to, I look at it, and what I see in my own work is that I needed about 10 more years to really get it right. But I would have starved.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you did an amazing job. I certainly think.
Thank you.
Yeah. Again, going back and forth between the novel and the short stories, and there's kind of an 11-year gap between them. About the second or third time I read through Drown, I began to think that the character of No Face... Or Yisrael, as he's sometimes called, is kind of the hero of the whole short story collection. And in the passage that the last passage you read from the book, No Face makes a quick return. Tell us a little bit about the character and what he meant to you, if you can.
Oof! I have a character in my first book, a kid who gets his. He's horribly disfigured. When he was an infant, he'd had his face eaten off by a pig, you know, and just terribly disfigured and in many ways brutalized and ostracized in the community in which he lived. And this was somebody that this had actually happened to somebody in the Dominican Republic. And an ex-girlfriend of mine had done work with this kid, and that story had stuck with me. I wanted to sort of introduce this character. And as you say, I introduced this character in a way because for my protagonist, he represents something of a sphinx. He's No Face Israel is a character that the protagonist, Junior, brutalizes in the mm-hmm. beginning. Mm-hmm. And then part of Junior's test is, I think throughout the book, both as a person and as a storyteller in Drown, is that the person that he ends up brutalizing in the beginning of the book is the person that he makes an enormous effort to humanize by the end.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think that you don't really grow up, I don't think, among the other places, you don't grow up until you can narrativize and humanize the people that you've done a tremendous harm to. I mean, most of us, we spend our lives thinking about the people who victimized us. Mm-hmm. I mean, shit, half a therapy is about, you know. But rarely do we enter into the idea, who have we done a tremendous harm to? And I don't think Junior as a character could have been the Junior of Oscar, as flawed as he was, if he hadn't had that moment where he's like, I disfigured and brutalized this kid, and I'm no victim, mm-hmm. you know, that there's a relationship here.
Right. Also, the fact that at the end of the penultimate story in Drown, Israel, No Face, is like a hero. He's still running. He's still going on in spite of all of the horrible things that we've seen happen to him in the very, very
yeah.
first story. And you almost want to think, you want to say, well, you know, if he can do it, I got nothing to complain about. I
yeah.
don't know. You know.
Yeah. And the fact that the brothers brutalizing Israel is a really big part of their kind of narrative and their mythology. But when you see Israel later, you realize that it's not even a blip on his map.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
And I think that that's the hardest thing to deal with for all of us, is when we realize that we're usually minor characters in everyone else's stories. You know, we're not the great hero, and
right, yeah.
That's hard to deal with.
Yeah,
you know,
mm-hmm. Yeah. You do the same in an odd way. I don't want to give away, you know, the real ending of Oscar Wilde, but you do the same thing with the very ending of the novel. I will say no more. You guys go out and read it if you haven't, or if you have, read it again. You'll have a great time if you
do. it is a book. I mean, this is why I think the questions about genre and science fiction are so relevant. And you know this very well, Chip, because this is stuff that you've in some ways innovated. This is a book that's all about reading. This is a book that's really scrapped together the way the Frankenstein monster is scrapped together from scavenged dead body parts. This is a book that's scrapped together from dead books or books. You know, it's like the Frankenstein done with books. And part of the reason I say that you know much about this is because of the idea of how we read. I mean, one of the things that, you know, Chip Delaney, when he's wearing his hat as a critic, one of the things that he talks about is how this idea of science fiction, like what is science fiction, to reduce it in a simple way, one of the things you say is that, you know, science fiction is a way of reading. Mm. And in some ways, I wanted this book to be all about reading and readers. And so that's why there was so much of the science fiction stuff, because again, when you get a science fiction fan, are there any science fiction fans out here? And they rowdy. Good. Yeah. When you get a science fiction fan and they start reading a book, like you say in a lot of your critical work, they begin to piece the world together
right.
based on clues. And the one thing about being an immigrant writer, yeah, for me, the Dominican Republic, trying to narrativize it in a world like the United States, where the Dominican Republic carries no weight. Rhode Island carries more weight than Santo Domingo. Mm-hmm. You know, despite how much power the United States have had in the Dominican Republic, for me, the Dominican Republic, creating it as a writer, is like creating a secondary world as a science fiction writer. Mm-hmm. You've got to create a secondary world the same way that people will read a book and they start reading and they're like, oh, this is space opera because of these clues. I had to do a similar thing with the Dominican Republic, because even though I've lived in it, to narrativize it and to communicate it to other people who are not used to imagining a United States simultaneously with a place like Santo Domingo, a lot of the strategies that I depended on these ideas that you and many other critics have talked about, it, how people read and how people build secondary worlds from clues in their reading.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. I've now seen you read, I guess, 3 or 4 times, which is, it's always a wonderful experience.
The kindest dude I know.
It's not kindness, believe me. It's humility and awe. But one of the things that a repeated thing in the readings that I've seen you do, you're very sensitive to the younger people in your audience. And you're very much aware, and you're particularly concerned about Latino youngsters who come and talk to you. A lot of the things that you say are kind of aimed towards that. And the two books that you have, the Oscar Wilde and Drown, are books that the young can read, and the old and presumably wise, can also read. Why is there this concern for the? You don't see that in every writer who comes to give a reading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, Chip, that's a great question. I mean, look, guys, as writers, we all have, and some writers, it's difficult to identify. We have our chronotope, yeah, our time space. You know, where is it that our work comes out of? You know, the easy example, the example I always use is Joseph Conrad. Joseph Conrad's chronotope is that damn river in Africa.
Right.
He never got off that river,
mm-hmm.
You know. But, I mean, you understand, it was a serious part of his life. And I think for me, being a Dominican immigrant of African descent, growing up with Latino and black kids in a community, in a state, in a country, at a time where we were irrelevant. It's like irrelevant squared,
yeah.
You know? When we think about young people not having a voice now, it was, you know, I think it's an unchanged silencing. And for me, I always feel like the chronotope, the place I never get out of, is being a young brown immigrant kid in a country that does everything possible to erase young brown immigrant kids' futures. And I think part of why I'm interested in and preoccupied with it is because you never forget, unless you're really evil, you know. Hey, plenty of evil folks, yo, you know, but you never really forget. I mean, guys, you can pin 1,000 awards on someone like me, and every time I go to bed, I still remember my teacher saying, after giving a report, my teacher saying things like, oh, well, no, you're just completely wrong, even though I knew my shit was completely right, just because they didn't want to hear from this kid. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that stays with you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And for nerves, too.
Yeah.
You talk to you guys when you're nervous. You guys always say some wild shit that makes me smile. It calms me down.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there is that childhood experience. With me, it was an English teacher in my second year of high school. Standing in front of a class, looking at a paper that I'd written and saying, what is this, a joke? And somehow you turn that into wanting to be a writer. How you do that is a really complicated thing.
No, you just hit it. I mean, it's the craziest alchemy in the world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, you silence a group of people long enough, eventually some of them are going to be like, yo, I'm going to fucking say some shit.
Yeah.
You know, whether I'm going to do it in dance,
right?
Whether dance, art, you know, graffiti, it's that Henry, you know, that Sal Bellow thing about you can only push people down so far before they just explode on you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think of it as in the arts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of my favorite stories of yours is Negocios, which I talked about a little bit in the introduction. There, you may remember it, I called it a mini epic. And it is, because it's somehow, by the time, you know, it's about Ramon, the father of this family, and yet by the end, you really feel, or at least I really felt, that I was reading the story of lots and lots of people. You know, it was the story of lots and lots of men who had come to this country. Not all of them Dominican. You know, and it did it with such restraint and such reticence. It's awesome.
Oh, thank you.
One of the things that makes writing great is the fact that it does the wonderful things that it does so economically. Where did you get a sense for the necessity of this economy? I mean, I suggested maybe Carver might have had a little bit to do with it, but I'm sure there are other things that were much more important.
No, I think, look, part of it for me always was how I was always struck, and I was coming up as a writer in the first stage of writerly bloat, where, you know, every novel, like, have you looked at first novels recently? It's like every first novel is like 800 pages, you know? I mean, I look at if I line my books up from books written in the 40s and 50s, people were, you know, I mean, of course, with some exclusions, people were incredibly economical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people could bring, and I guess part of what was happening with me was that I had this challenge in my head. Can I tell my story, but can I tell it in the leanest way humanly possible? It was the same with the novel. I was trying to tell a story. I was like, can I tell the history of the modern Dominican Republic and one family in under 350 pages, where the temptation is to take 900 pages.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know what it is. For me, the more pages I use, the more sort of like the humanity of my characters get diluted. Mm. In other words, in 350 pages, I can keep my family feeling very, very human. Mm. At 700, they're kind of like wraiths. Mm-hmm. You know? Like, no, like I can do sentences, guys. I can put together incidents and paragraphs, and but I guess the words always have to coil around a certain amount of humanity. Mm-hmm. And I haven't yet generated more humanity plus anything above 250 pages. I haven't been able to do, you know.
I guess this has got to be a question that every writer at some point gets asked. So I will ask it of you. There is clearly so much of the material in the book and your stories comes from your family. What kind of response do you get or have you gotten from your family? Because some of the portraits are not, you know, are pretty rough. You know, so, all of them are people, all of them, and you are people that you end up greatly respecting. I feel that in all, you know. But I can see some people who, if they think of themselves as possibly the model, might not see this quite so clearly. Has that ever happened?
Wow. Thanks, Chip.
Okay.
Yeah, this is the question I have to, like, talk about my family.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, no, but part of it is, guys, I couldn't communicate, like, my family's, like, really weird. I don't know what it is. It's, like, it's maybe because we had this kind of brutal jerk of a military father or something, but you know, none of my siblings have ever given me any feedback on anything I've ever written. There's like a studious silence around it. No, I mean it. I mean it says a lot about my family. You know, it's I go home and they pretend that I never wrote anything, and I sort of, being the person I am, I just go along with it, you know. Someone else would probably be like, I'm a writer, damn you. You know? But I'm kind of like, I guess I'm always looking not to start drama in a family that loves fucking drama. So, yeah, but I, you know, the people who've been most, who've given me the most, it's interesting, but, you know, my immediate family, no, but my, my aunts and uncles are very happy to share their opinions.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So I get a lot of feedback and comments from them. And you know, my aunts to the young woman, has none of my aunts. They all think I let my family off easy. You know, they're all kind of like, they're always like, well, you know, you should have. I'm like,
you could have told about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Right. And I've always cared for my aunts very deeply, so I think, you know, these sisters are all on my side. Right. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. That,
don't you love these conversation things? We're always like, oh, Jesus.
The story Edison, New Jersey, which is about a guy who delivers pool tables, and you said, eventually takes a young woman from Edison to the Washington Heights, the Dominican neighborhood in New York at the time. And it sort of it resonates very deeply with the story Drowned, because it's somebody trying to get out of that the landscape that is so suffocating, that can be so suffocating, and she comes back, as I recall.
Yeah,
yeah. And she doesn't really leave it. What are some of the things that went into that story? Can you tell us anything
sure.
about any?
Yeah. Well, I used to deliver pool tables. I worked my way through college delivering pool tables, which is a big pain in the butt, you know. But it's also, if anyone who's done delivery, if you've ever been a delivery person for sort of high-end items, there's a specific invisibility that one has with the upper middle class and the upper classes, which is astonishing. You know, so I delivered pool tables these were Brunswick tables, very high-end. These were like, at that time, there was like $5,000 a table, which was an enormous amount of money. One of my experiences was that I would deliver pool tables to these incredibly wealthy communities, and that there would always be a little team of Latinos sustaining this enormous privilege. Mm-hmm. There would always be like a Latino nanny, someone in the garden, someone cooking, you know, and then I would be there delivering pool tables, you know, and it was kind of like all the little slaves get together and we whisper, you know, I mean, it really felt kind of like wild and just like this would have been familiar 300 years ago, except minus the me being allowed to leave, you know, but part of that story was I wanted to talk about that world where, again, it's like talk about being a ghost moving in and out of these things. But how many people that I met who were working in these households who were having incredibly rough times, but because of the situation they were in, there was no way they were leaving. You know, I used to always consider myself fortunate for most of the houses that I delivered pool tables to. After I would hear the owner yell at their Latino servant for some reason, I would always say, fuck, I get to leave.
Yeah.
You know, I really get to leave. And that was what I was thinking about when I wrote that story. That even the woman who the narrator drives to visit her family and her friends, in the end, it's only a temporary flight.
Yeah.
Like you said, she returns.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt like a lot of the social economic conditions that I was familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the dream of flight, is that a dream?
Yeah, one of the things that gives so much of your work a kind of weight and resonance is the fact that you will deal with the work people do, you know, the work that they actually do. Did you ever think about that specifically,
and
the necessity in literature of reflecting work?
Yeah, man. I mean, again, if you're an immigrant, you didn't come here because you are scheming to steal money from, like, white folks. You know, this idea that, like, immigrants come because they want to steal jobs, you know, and, like, they want to get all sorts of things. It's nonsense. You know, it's absolute nonsense. If you're an immigrant like me, the reason you came, the end-all, be-all, is work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was an immigrant. I watched my mother and my father work themselves into an almost a form of inhumanity. And that stuff leaks into you as a kid. When you see your parents working like this, it's almost expected that you're going to do the same.
Mm-hmm.
I watched me and my oldest four siblings from an early age, that kind of work madness of immigration was upon us. I mean, as soon as we could lie about our age, we had jobs. Because I would see my poor mother working like a beast. So we were thinking, oh, we will work and hope to take up the slack.
Mm-hmm.
And I think work, though not as much as it used to be, it's like any of the sectors. Look, there's so much that hasn't been touched upon at the level of art. There's a billion stories that haven't been told. And even the stories that have been told, even within them, there's such enormous silences. And for me, just talking a little bit about work is nothing compared to the amount of work and amount of stories that need to be told. I'm always like, man, we've got about 1% of the kind of writers that we need. You know? I mean, honestly, I can't tell you enough that despite the proliferation of books and how many writers there are, still 99% of the stories that we need to complete our sense of what the human is are missing. And work is a huge area. You know, we don't get much information about work.
Juno, thank you so much. And I'm sure everybody feels very much the same way.
Thank you, Chip. Oh, thank you so much, you guys.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.